Lecture 6, Espionage in the American Revolution.
It is September 23rd, 1780, a cool fall morning. You are riding through Westchester County, New York, on a mission. It's already almost complete. You have met the secret agent whom you've been managing as his handler, and he is a high American military commander. He has passed you crucial documents, and these you have hidden in your boot to take back with you. Now you're on your way back to the British forces with documents that are supposed to provide you protection. These are documents identifying you as an American intelligence agent. Your American name is John Anderson. And you feel sure that these documents will give you security if you're stopped by American soldiers. On reflection, however, it may actually not be so easy for you to pass as an American because you're not. You're a sophisticated, worldly, well-educated, and dashing major in the British Army. You see ahead of you a bridge over a small river, and you discern a little bit too late three men standing at that bridge, their muskets at the ready. Who are they? Are they British? Are they Americans? If they're Americans, what kind are they? Are they rebels? Or are they loyalists favorable to the British cause? It's too late to turn around now without being noticed. Now, what would you do next in this situation? Espionage in the war for American independence would flourish because it was a tragically, if marvelously, well-suited context for espionage. A once united colonial society was being torn apart. As colonial society in North America split between patriots and loyalists over questions of independence or British rule continuing, there were elements here of an American Civil War. Some historians have estimated that roughly a third of American society was patriot, opting for independence, a third loyalist or Tory, favoring continued British rule, and a third, undecided or indifferent. Now, in our previous lecture, we had mentioned the amazing role of D'Eon in the Seven Years' War. This worldwide war was known as the French and Indian War in North America, and it had ended in British victory in 1763. Because the British had won, the French threat had been repelled from the American colonies. And so American colonists felt free to breathe a sigh of relief and take a new look at their situation. They discovered that some of them saw themselves not merely as British subjects, but as something quite distinct, as Americans. The catalyst for a growing movement for American self-assertion, self-identification, and self-rule came from fears of conspiracies, in particular, the colonists' anxiety that the British monarchy and Parliament were determined to take away the colonists' constitutional liberties and rights and to move the British Empire in the direction of absolutism and a rule that was less democratic. When the British Crown sought to recoup the expenses of the recent war with new taxes and regulations on what trade would be permitted, this antagonized the colonists further and fed into their anxiety about conspiracies. Activists organized into a secret society called the Sons of Liberty. The Sons of Liberty spread propaganda for the patriot cause, and when it came to the revolution, would form a crucial network for intelligence gathering that had already been established in advance. Similarly, throughout the colonies, committees of correspondence, as they were called, were organized to link up like-minded patriots across the colonies. Tensions continued to grow. And one event in particular, imprinted on American collective memory, combined covert action with propaganda effect. This was the Boston Tea Party in December of 1773, when patriots dressed as Native Americans threw packages of tea into the harbor in protest against new taxes. A Continental Congress gathered in Philadelphia in September of 1774, and then active war broke out in April of 1775. When patriots had learned of British troop movements to seize arms that the colonists had stockpiled, Paul Revere, a patriot, rode his epic ride to warn of the coming of the British forces. When the British soldiers advanced from Boston to Concord, they were met with a firefight on Lexington Green, and the war was on. At this point, a colonial government had to be organized to lead the struggle. George Washington, a Virginia planter who had distinguished himself already in the French and Indian War, was made the new commander of the new Continental Army. On the diplomatic front, Congress sent Benjamin Franklin to Paris to seek assistance from that old enemy of Britain, the French Kingdom. Franklin was already well known as an Enlightenment thinker, as a printer, as an inventor, and when he traveled to Paris, his status was that of a rock star. Just as had been the case with the Chevalier d'Eon on his return to France, everyone wanted to meet Franklin. Everyone wanted to see this backwoods philosopher and to bask in his presence. And so Franklin, who was a tremendously canny man, proved a very effective diplomat. But he was also a diplomat under secret surveillance. He was being observed all the time that he was active in Paris on his diplomacy by a British agent, a fellow scientist from America, Dr. Edward Bancroft. And it's been said that this shows the charming and naive side in Franklin, that he assumed that someone who was a fellow scientist must be trustworthy on other counts as well. The record was an appalling one. From 1776 to the British capitulation at Yorktown in October of 1781, Bancroft sent far more detailed information that he had learned from hanging around Franklin about America's international relations and its foreign policy than reached the Continental Congress or General Washington. And yet, some historians surmise that the clandestine efforts of Bancroft appear not to have changed the outcome. Some scholars suggest that, in fact, Franklin knew that Bancroft was a spy, but found it useful to have the British know by this channel about the progress he was making, as this would put further pressure on the British to negotiate a settlement of their own. If we think all the way back to the case of the Persian king, who had shown the Greek spies everything they wanted to see about the kingdom and used truth as a weapon, Franklin was doing something similar, perhaps. Soon after he took military command, Washington also took on another role, that of spy master. Maybe we should allow that to just sink in for a moment. This fact comes as a surprise to us, given our image of Washington as the man who could not tell a lie. In fact, Washington had a crucial role in organizing deception and secret operations in the war, as has been argued in an elegant brief book by Thomas B. Allen entitled, aptly, George Washington, Spy Master. Indeed, in his own intelligence apparatus, George Washington had a code name. He was Agent 711. Imagine that. The father of our country was Agent 711. George Washington devoted much attention to intelligence, appreciating its importance. From 1775 to 1781, he devoted not just attention, but also an astonishing amount of money to the tasks of espionage. He spent in that period the astounding total of $17,617 on espionage undertakings. The activities of Washington spies included setting up communications systems, relays of messages, and these would often be passed in a new and improved kind of invisible ink, the so-called two-bottle system. Let me explain for a moment. Invisible inks were common and had been around for a long time. An example is the use of lemon juice to write on paper, which is invisible until the paper is exposed to heat and the lemon juice turns brown. By contrast, the two-bottle system involved invisible writing that would not become legible by the simple expedient of heating. Rather, it used an ink in one bottle that chemically could only be revealed when brushed with the right corresponding chemical solution held in the other bottle, hence the two-bottle system. This was already quite sophisticated science for the day. Washington's spies also worked on the use of elaborate ciphers, the production of fake dispatches that were left lying around to fall into the hands of the enemy as disinformation that would mislead them. The spies also worked at foiling assassination and kidnapping plots against Washington himself. They worked at the spreading of propaganda, such as leaflets that were handed to the German mercenaries in British service in the American colonies called Hessians, who hailed from the state of Hesse-Kassel or other German principalities. Those leaflets were printed in German, and they promised free land for anyone who would desert from the British service, and found many takers. It's estimated that some 5,000 Hessians actually deserted during the war. These activities also involved unmasking sleeper agents insinuated into the Patriot ranks. There was one such moment that was especially bitter for Washington, when someone that he'd regarded as a loyal patriot and a friend was revealed as a sleeper agent. This was Dr. Benjamin Church, who had been appointed as the chief medical officer in the American Army, but had been a spy all along. As it turns out, Church's career as a spy had begun significantly before. He was a graduate of Harvard. Church had belonged to the Sons of Liberty in the days of agitating for American identity and independence. And he'd been accepted as a fellow patriot while all the time he was serving as a spy for the British. This bitter revelation came by a most convoluted series of events. Washington's officers brought to him a young woman who had been captured in the act of trying to get a coded letter to a British warship off of Newport, Rhode Island. Washington took the coded message and gave copies of that message to two of his best decoders. And they were supposed to work separately, independently, so that the results would be independently verified rather than at the mercy of a misinterpretation by one decoder. And think back to tradecraft and its imperatives. Having built-in redundancies is considered a very good way of verifying results. And this is what Washington did. And lo and behold, both decoders, working apart from one another, brought him the same decoded message. In it, Church reported to the British on American military plans and the state of the American army. Washington was furious and saddened. He organized a court-martial to try Churchill, with Washington at its head. They were not capable of convicting him for the full crime of espionage, but rather judged that he was guilty of criminal correspondence with the enemy. Church was put in jail, but later was released to leave for exile in the West Indies around 1778 in one of the first modern spy swaps in modern history, traded for a prisoner that the British were holding. But Church's ship was actually lost at sea on its way to exile. Washington, in spite of this bitter disappointment, was a quick learner in subterfuge and was in fact glad to lie and spread disinformation for a greater purpose. As when he put about the word that his army had 1,800 barrels of gunpowder, when in fact it only had 36. Washington also set about instituting a special operations branch in his military. In 1776, he ordered Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Knowlton, a hero of the battle at Bunker Hill, to set up a reconnaissance force. And this came to be known after its commander as the Knowlton Rangers. As America's original military intelligence organization, this is regarded today as the ancestor of the present Special Forces, Army Rangers, and Delta Force. An early American colonist hero in the shadow war of espionage was the young spy Nathan Hale. Nathan Hale was a graduate of Yale University and had gone on to be a school teacher and had become a member of Knowlton's Rangers. When the British were capturing New York City, which at that point was not the vast metropolis it is today, but in fact only a settlement on the southern tip of Manhattan around Wall Street, Hale was sent there as a spy. He was disguised as a Dutch schoolmaster to allow him to mix in with the local population. He encountered a man who convinced him that he too was an American special agent. In fact, this was a British counterintelligence officer who had tricked Hale into thinking that Hale was among friends. And then he was captured and found to be carrying documents in his shoes. Hale was sentenced to hang in 1776. And just before his death, he's said to have declared, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country," end quote. He was then hanged and buried in an unmarked grave. There are statues of Hale as an exemplary patriot spy throughout the United States in public places and in some that are not so public, including the one at the CIA headquarters at Langley, Virginia. Washington personally supervised some spying at first, but a key to leadership and effective management is delegation. So it was crucial to institutionalize the job and allow others to take over some of these tasks. The first formal American intelligence organization was set up, directed by Major Benjamin Talmadge of the Connecticut Cavalry, a friend of the late Nathan Hale, and like him, a Yale graduate. He was no professional and would have to learn as he went. In that sense, he was like Sir Francis Walsingham, needing to invent his own job. His tasks included preparing for operations behind enemy lines, sabotage, and guerrilla warfare. Washington dealt directly with Talmadge rather than micromanaging his handling of individual agents. And this shows already the movement towards a more bureaucratically advanced and organized structure, because centralized control is maintained without micromanagement from above. Talmadge's spies included a lady living across from the British commander, General Sir William Howe, in Philadelphia. Another group of spies was the famed Culper Ring in New York. These were spies who had a wonderfully effective cover because they posed as loyalist printers and seemed to be very much committed to the loyalist cause. Another of their number was a storekeeper in New York, Robert Townsend, another Yale graduate, whose shop was frequented by British officers who tended to speak loosely, feeling they were among friends and revealed secrets. It's compelling to notice that women agents played an important role. Anna Smith Strong, for instance, helped the Culper Ring by signaling on her washing line in code where messages needed to be directed in the relay system. Hers was an important role. There's also another story concerning Old Mom Rinker, as she was known, in Germantown. Germantown now is inside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but at that time was in the wild region beyond Philadelphia's limits. Old Mom Rinker would sit knitting as she bleached flax atop a cliff near her family's tavern. When the time was right, she would drop a ball of yarn off the cliff, which had been wrapped up containing messages in the middle, to be retrieved by watching American agents who would then take them to Washington's headquarters. In Philadelphia itself, Lydia Dara, whose son was a soldier with Washington, passed on what she heard from British officers who had been quartered or put up in her home. The story of espionage in the American Revolution that is probably best known today concerns treason. Benedict Arnold, a name that is synonymous with treachery into our own times, the betrayal of one's country. Yet, paradoxically, Arnold had started as a famous patriot hero. He had led a crucial attack at the victory of Saratoga, New York, and had been badly wounded in his valiant effort. The American victory at Saratoga was really a turning point in history, as it convinced the French, potential allies of the Americans, that an alliance with the colonists was a good idea because their cause was viable. They could win on the battlefield. And historians delight in underlining a real irony. If Benedict Arnold had been killed at Saratoga after his valiant fighting there, he would probably be remembered today as a founding hero rather than as a traitor. Certainly, Washington valued Benedict Arnold as an able commander. After the British pulled out of Philadelphia in June 1778, the badly wounded Arnold, who couldn't fight on the battlefield at this point, was put in charge of the city. And there he fell in love. He fell in love with and married Peggy Shippen, the sparkling, vivacious daughter of a Tory family in Philadelphia. Arnold was 37. She was 18. And there was also prehistory. Earlier, when Philadelphia had been under British control, Peggy Shippen had dallied with the chief of British intelligence in the colonies, Major John Andre. Arnold increasingly was disappointed, even in his new post in Philadelphia, with what he felt was the lack of recognition for his achievements and his sacrifices. And he also felt financial pressure to keep his wife in the standard of glittering social life to which she was accustomed. At this point, Benedict Arnold took a fateful step. He volunteered his services to the British, and a correspondence in code with Major Andre began. Arnold was later put in charge of West Point, the strategic fort overlooking the Hudson River. He wrote in July 1780 to the British that he was willing to give up West Point for what today would be over $1 million. If West Point could be taken, the results could be decisive. the British would be able to cut off the northeastern colonies and perhaps win the war. On September 23rd, Benedict Arnold and André met, and Arnold gave his contact sketches of the defenses of West Point. André put the sketches in his boot. André was disguised as a civilian, and this proved to be fatal. If André were captured out of uniform, he would be executed as a spy, while uniformed soldiers would only be made prisoners of war. On his way back to the British lines, this is the scene with which we began this lecture, André was captured by a patrol at Tarrytown, New York. It was a mistake of a moment that sufficed to seal his fate. As André approached the three men, he thought or concluded that they were British soldiers, that he'd reached the British lines. And apparently the reason for this was the mistake was because one of the Americans, as it turns out, American soldiers, was wearing a Hessian coat, which he had found somewhere. Thinking they were British, André approached them and told them that he was a British officer. And then he realized his terrible mistake, because they were Americans, not uniformed British soldiers. He tried to pretend it was a joke. That didn't really work. And then offered to bribe them in order to release him. But they would not do so. And instead, he was taken to the American command post. When Benedict Arnold learned that André had been captured, he fled to the British. And it is recorded that when Washington learned of Benedict's treason, he did something that no one had ever seen him do before. And that was to weep in public. Washington then turned from weeping to fury. He communicated to the British that he would be willing to trade their soldier, André, for the return of Benedict Arnold. When the British refused to exchange him for Arnold, André was hanged on October 2, 1780. A fateful mistake repeated several times. If André had not taken off his uniform, his fate might have been different by the established rules of war at the time. Later in 1821, André's body was reburied in Westminster Abbey in London in an honored place as a celebrated hero of the British war effort. For his part, Benedict Arnold's post-treason career on the British side was not a happy one. People didn't trust a traitor. He was not trusted by the British, nor entrusted with a higher office that he felt he should have deserved on their side. And to top it all off, now his name stands for betrayal in American memory, not the sort of immortality that one would want to have. For their part, the British intelligence record was not as good as the American, but that was not due to a lack of British talent. It was probably due more to the challenges of being on unfamiliar territory and finding it hard to come by the local knowledge that would allow the British forces to know precisely whom to trust among the Americans. Information, even from seeming Tories or loyalists, could prove to be disinformation, and thus sometimes was disregarded. A notorious example of disregarding warnings came at Trenton, New Jersey. Recall that on Christmas night, 1776, George Washington and his men, in secret, crossed the Delaware River and thus surprised and captured the garrison of Hessian mercenaries in Trenton, New Jersey. About 20 Hessians were killed, some 800 captured, and only 4 Americans wounded. The Hessian commander was among those killed, and in his pocket was found a letter from a loyalist giving advance warning of the attack, but the letter had not been opened, an intelligence failure. It's only fair then also to mention, sort of for parallel purposes, a fiasco involving the American cause, not engineered by the Americans, but in their name. This involved what today would be called a walk-in spy, or a covert operator, a volunteer who was of British origin, who offered to help the Americans to take the war to Britain's own backyard, its own country, and sabotage the British war effort by burning the British Navy. This man was named James Aiken, and also James Boswell, alias James Hind, alias James Hill, alias John the Painter. You can probably see a pattern there already. He was a 25-year-old house painter from Edinburgh in Scotland, and a robber, and a pyromaniac, who had led a wandering, unstable existence for many years. He'd lived for some years in the American colonies and then returned to Britain. But above all, he was a man with a dream, and that dream was to become a British officer. When the British spurned this ambition, not surprisingly, he conceived of the idea on the basis of a conversation held in a bar. That's always probably a bad idea. of becoming someone who would commit a decisive act and thus become an American hero, if he couldn't be a British one. With very limited support from American officials who were very skeptical about him, he returned to Britain from France, where he had met with American officials, in the fall of 1776, tried to burn down Portsmouth, the British naval installation, with incendiary devices of his own design. But unfortunately for his purposes, he used cheap matches, which meant that he couldn't really get these started and was only able to set a fire in one shipyard. He was immediately arrested. He'd made himself very conspicuous beforehand, and then was hanged in March of 1777 as a huge crowd of 20,000 onlookers watched this celebrity arsonist. His body was later hung for a month outside the shipyard that he had tried to destroy as a warning to anyone who might have similar ideas. This strange and sad figure has in fact been called by one historian the first modern terrorist, for his attempt to change world affairs by a desperate personal action. At long last, with French intervention on the side of the Americans and the cornering and surrender of the British forces at Yorktown in 1781, peace negotiations began with a treaty signed in 1783, and American independence had been won. The British spymaster in America, Major Beckwith, later declared, "Washington did not really outfight the British. He simply outspied us." It was a blend of tribute and complaint at the same time. I would also like to mention in closing some aspects of the aftermath of the war. The growing United States now was concerned with intelligence in the vast hinterland that lay beyond the Mississippi. President Thomas Jefferson secretly requested from Congress in 1803 financing for a reconnaissance trip into those territories. Napoleon offered to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States, and the sale was completed that summer. Jefferson's own personal secretary, Captain Meriwether Lewis, along with William Clark, led a secret expedition into those territories. Finally, how were espionage and the secret war for independence remembered? Recall that Nathan Hale was mentioned as a brave spy, an honorable spy. Others were not so celebrated in the aftermath. In some cases, in fact, to protect relatives living in Britain, some former Patriot spies hid their history entirely, and it was only passed down in the family as family lore. Women spies who'd played an important role also were not celebrated enthusiastically in spite of their contribution. This era did, however, produce an important literary monument. It's one of the earliest American novels, which showed that literature by Americans about America could be quite popular and successful. This was James Fenimore Cooper's 1821 novel, The Spy, A Tale of the Neutral Ground. It testified to the painful divisions within society and families that the War for Independence had involved. The novel is set in Westchester, New York, and the story narrates the tangled mess of love and family loyalty and political loyalty. The neutral ground to which Cooper's subtitle referred was the disputed county of Westchester itself, divided between those who supported the British or the Americans. A civil war raging often in the same family. The novel, apart from the love stories that it involves, focuses on the lowly peddler, Harvey Birch. This is not a genteel or aristocratic figure like Major Andre, but rather a rough American type who always seems to be spitting streams of chewing tobacco all over the place. Harvey Birch seems in the novel at first to be a Tory spy, but is in fact a double agent serving Washington, who also makes a cameo appearance in the novel. A key message of the story was that a common man like Harvey Birch could make a great contribution to the cause of the Republic. In this lecture, we've observed the tragic and compelling agonies of a society tearing itself apart. And as society comes apart into new loyalties, it's in the areas between those formerly united units that espionage and covert action can proliferate. We'll turn next to the wrenching efforts to build up empires and new nation states in our next lecture.